We've spoken a lot throughout this about healthcare service and all the issues that are possible to have when you've got chronic illness. How do you think we can make healthcare services more accessible?
So I think the hospitals or universities where people are training to become any type of medical professional, I feel like it would be a good idea if they set up like focus groups where patients can share their personal story. This should include med and nursing students as well as consultants, but it should also have patients with different experiences, you know, like whether they're textbook or non-textbook, whether they've been diagnosed like yesterday or whether they were diagnosed 20 years ago. And in that group, they should brainstorm ideas and thoughts and then hopefully update the medical data about IOH, because I feel like medical data about IOH is very outdated, because obviously, as we spoke earlier about like pseudo tumor and like being overweight causes it, I feel like those two pieces of information alone are very outdated.
Yeah, definitely. Well, talking about the focus groups, doing the degree I'm doing, I have sat through medical school lectures and done their part of their module. There are symposiums that we have to attend and that medical students have to attend, which is basically when they bring patients in to talk about their experiences, but also do like the theory, like the science-y medical side of it with their lecturers. Yeah. But what I've noticed is, so far, those have only been for stroke, dementia. We had one on drugs and addiction, but they're very, what I would call, common things that we don't, what you and I have is not necessarily common, and the way we're treated, they should do symposiums on these sorts of conditions. But the other issue is that it's so rare to get a patient who necessarily feels well enough to go into medical schools and do those talks, because it is quite time consuming to go and do those things.
Definitely, yeah. No, I just think realizing that like medical, like what's the word?
Professionals.
Not that, the medical world, I can't think of the exact word.
The medical field.
Yeah, that's the word. It's like constantly changing. Like, it's not the same as it was 20 years ago. It's constantly changing. And like, the doctors need to like take more notice to that.
Agreed, because something my friends will repeat to me often is at some point they had no clue what dementia was and what caused it, and they thought that was fake, but now it is a well-known medical issue. So that's due to the advancing in technology, and that's the sort of thing that needs to be, we've got the advanced technology now, so why have we not figured these things out? Unfortunately, that's mine and Ray's job as the neuroscientists to figure these parts out. So
I feel like aside from like our job, because I'm going into academia, it should also be on like the doctors to try and at least keep themselves up to date with the research that's coming out, because there's a lot of research that comes out on like a regular basis, like even if it's not like novel research all the time, it's like reviews and they're like ideas that are proposed and like potential reasoning behind why things might be caused, and it turns out like a lot of like medical professionals might not just know that this exists, so like having that sort of like access and just the knowledge that this might be it, and also like the personal willingness to like to keep themselves up to date, it also kind of like needs to be there.
But then I guess, like, kind of playing devil's advocate in a sense, they have so much, they're so overworked, that where is the time? There needs to be, I think, a whole restructuring of the healthcare system to be able to let healthcare professionals have the time they need to keep up to date with what's going on in the medical world, and to also be able to give time to the patients without overworking themselves, because doctors who overwork themselves are going to miss things.
Because I agree with that a lot, but I think the biggest thing is the attitude.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the attitude.
Because another thing I wanted to add is I feel like they need to be trained to listen to what the patient is saying rather than trying to get the patient to match the patient's words to match with the textbook. Like, sure, the patient is gonna match the textbook to some extent because otherwise they wouldn't have the diagnosis, but they're not gonna match exactly to the textbook.
I feel like I have to say I've got a symptom that maybe I don't have, or leave out a symptom that I do have just to get a diagnosis. But you shouldn't have to change what's going on with you to fit the diagnosis. The diagnosis should be given based on the set of symptoms that do correlate to it, and figure out what symptom the like outlier symptom relates to.
Exactly. There's one thing that I remember that my psychiatrist, when I was getting diagnosed with like ADHD and just anxiety in general, she said, because I didn't fit all the symptoms of ADHD, is that she mentioned how the DSM criteria is very rigid in terms of the way it's structured. And I feel like that's just in terms of like diagnostic procedures, it's very strict. And it's not always the case with patients, because they can it's not black and white. There are shades of grey. There's overlap between different symptoms. You might have some symptoms. You might not have some symptoms. That doesn't mean that you're lying about your condition, or that doesn't mean that you necessarily like you don't have the condition or anything like that. And that shouldn't be the basis to like discredit someone or like what they're experiencing. The diagnostic procedure should be sort of like used as a reference to like, instead of like having the patient match exactly as to like what's been outlined.
I mean, I recently saw a rheumatologist consultant who kind of like said exactly what you're saying, that one of the things she said was, I didn't necessarily meet the criteria on the, I don't know if you guys know the Beighton scale, which is a criteria for EDS. She said, I don't meet it to get 6 out of 9. I only meet it to get 5 out of 9, which is technically not enough for an EDS diagnosis. But what she said is, the Beighton scale does not take into consideration specific joints that I am incredibly hypermobile in. And she was like, so taking in holistically your case, you do have EDS, but if we were going by the diagnostic criteria, I couldn't diagnose you with it, at which point I wouldn't be getting the help that I'm hopefully meant to be getting soon.
So it's really good that you did get to see that doctor, because like I said, when I got my original IOH diagnosis, it takes that one doctor. They're the best types.
Definitely. So the next sort of question was, we've spoken a lot about schools and universities and education in general. How can other institutions like schools aid their students or staff with IIH or any sort of chronic illness?
So allowing the person with IIH to take breaks as and when they need. Not making the person with IIH to feel different from those without IIH. And I think the biggest one is not penalising the person with IIH if they have to take time off for a hospital appointment. Because when I was in school, I don't think they liked that I had so many appointments during school time. I think they thought it was like a dentist appointment, but in reality, we can't decide when our hospital appointments are going to be. Like a dentist appointment, you can plan to have them on a weekend, but like a hospital appointment, I think through my whole life, I've had one appointment on a Saturday, and that was a shock.
Like, also, with hospital appointments, you can only rearrange them, I think, once, maybe twice before they put you at the back of the waiting list. So it's not even as if you can actually do anything about it when it lands on a school day.
Exactly, like it's literally like it's completely out of our hands. Like our consultants have other patients that aren't just us, and like I actually haven't heard of someone having a hospital appointment on a weekend. Sure, they have it occasionally, but most often hospital appointments are on a weekday. So it's highly likely that you're going to have to take time off school, work, uni to go to the appointment.
Yeah, it's also unfair to assume that just because they're a medical professional, they're going to go in on what is considered a weekend and work days. If they're working on their weekends, then they're not going to do that. So you have to go during their work day, which is Monday to Friday during school time.
Exactly. It's completely out of our hands. Whereas like everyone knows that like a dentist, for example, everyone knows that they work on a Saturday and Sunday because I guess that's probably, I take it, most people probably book the time off to go to the dentist then.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of in a classroom with teachers and whatnot, is there anything specific? Obviously, you were talking about TAs before. Is there anything specific that you think teachers can do to help you learn in those situations or while you're in hospital, that sort of thing?
So like the class teacher?
Yeah.
I think just like sending me the work and like not necessarily saying get this done, but like more so like sending me the work and like saying here's the work, try and get it done if you can, but if you can't I'll go over it with you when you return to school. Like that would have been helpful for me, but I didn't have that. And also another thing is, so do you remember during COVID obviously we had Teams lessons?
Yeah.
Now when all of that like stopped and everyone returned back to school and it was like more like quote unquote normal, when I started having time off school then, I would ask for like Teams lessons, just like even if I wasn't writing anything, just for me to sit and listen so I wasn't too far behind.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to do the Teams lessons. They were like to me, no, we only did those for COVID, but we're not going to Teams you just because you're the only student. When it's like, yeah, but when COVID was going along and it was at that stage where people were in school but people were constantly off for isolation, like if it was like, say there was only like one student that was in isolation, the teacher would be perfectly happy to Teams them. But like when I needed time off for something that wasn't related to COVID, it was just like my chronic health condition, I wasn't allowed the Teams calls because apparently they're only allowed to be for COVID situations.
I totally relate to that. Yeah, like
I literally don't get it.
Yeah, they would let it for specific things, but not other things. It's even, I mean, your university is online, but I've asked multiple times, is it possible to do hybrid learning? So put a Teams call on. So if on the days I don't feel well, I can still participate and watch things during the lesson time instead of afterwards. And it's no, we can't do that. And I just don't understand. It doesn't, in my school specifically, still had Teams. So it didn't cost them anything to just set a meeting and let me join. And that's where I don't understand. It doesn't cost them anything extra. It doesn't take any more time than 5 seconds to start it and stop it. And they wouldn't be willing to do it.
I really don't understand it, because also I feel like they're making their job harder as well, because by them not agreeing to teaming you, they then have to take time out of their day to try and help you catch up. Whereas if they teams called you, although you may need to go to them for some, like to ask them some questions to like clarify the lesson, you wouldn't need as long of a session with them helping you as you would if, you know, the flip side.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, the amount of, I think, yeah, that's a really valid point you just raised. The amount of people who for COVID were allowed to, but not for anything else.
I literally don't understand it, why COVID was like the reason that like they put this all into place. It shouldn't, like this should have been like, even without COVID, this should have happened.
No, yeah, agreed. And especially after COVID, when it was proven that it doesn't work great, because there's been a lot of showing that the students' education was stunted during that period of time, but it's better than nothing at all. So why are we not continuing that?
I completely agree. And also just like having that option there, like it's crazy.
No, yeah, totally agree. So in terms of if somebody were to be newly diagnosed with IAH, Or even what do you wish you had been told when you were diagnosed? What advice would you give?
So my biggest piece of advice is that they're not alone and they will get through it.
Yeah.
Also, just like a small piece of advice, but it is actually quite helpful. Bring sunglasses everywhere with you. You never know when you're going to need them. Even just inside, I need them.
Yeah.
If you end up having brain surgery for it, you may feel so ill while you're recovering that you may just completely regret having the surgery, because I do, like, honestly, I feel awful the days after surgery. But once the recovery period is over, the difference I feel is crazy. Like, you will definitely see the benefits of the surgery and you'll feel so much better. And you will realize that choosing to go for the surgery was a good decision.
Yeah.
Also, if you end up having brain surgery, put the half of your hair that your surgeon won't be operating on into like a plait or something. Because your surgeon, they usually tell you what side of the brain they're operating on, which is very helpful. So obviously that will help minimize hair loss, because hair loss in brain surgery, obviously you get it from them shaving your head. But a lot of my hair loss comes from the brain surgery really matting my hair. Like,
yeah,
it, like, my hair is literally like, because obviously, like, they put stuff on your head to make sure you don't get an infection, and then mix that with like blood and like everything else that comes out in surgery. My hair is literally dead when I come out of surgery, because also you're not allowed to wash it for like the first few weeks, depending on the surgery and like the healing time of your wound. So usually by the time I'm able to wash my hair, I literally get so much of it fall out in the shower, and that's with me tying my hair up. So if I went into surgery with my hair down, I actually, like, I feel like I would lose so much more hair.
That's like, genuinely would not have thought of that as something.
Yeah. Yeah. That's... You lose so much hair with brain surgery. Like, it's really weird, because like, it's not just like having it shaved. Like, you come out of surgery and you think, oh, I haven't lost that much hair. But no, it's like the after effect of like how matted it becomes, like from not being able to wash it.
Is that something that's affected you then, like losing the hair
loss?
Yeah,
definitely. Luckily for me, so my surgeons, so obviously I have a middle part in, and what they do is, so my surgeries are always on this side of my brain, what's that, the right side. They always flip my hair over. So can you see here?
Oh yeah. Like
that, so my, it's usually like here, so like here and like back here. So I have a lot of hair loss on this half of my head. So it does really help me that they flip it over, so I'm able to hide that hair loss. The only time that people do see the hair loss is like when I'm recovering from surgery, because obviously the wound is fresh, so I have to keep the wound clear from it, because I don't want an infection. But once that's over, I'm able to cover it up and like almost hide the hair loss. And like, I will admit, the hair loss really gets to me, because like this side of my head is so much thicker than like this side, and like it really does get to me. And also I feel like it's kind of like an indication of like how long it's been since I've had surgery. Like, the longer my hair is, the longer I've gone without having surgery.
Yeah.
So when it's like at that stage where it's like almost bald, it's like a reminder that I've literally just had surgery.
Yeah, I guess that's, especially with having 30, I don't know if it's something that people think, that after having so many of something, you get used to it and it's not hard to deal with anymore, but it still is hard. It's something you have to go through every single time.
It really is, because also I have naturally curly hair. Both my parents had curly hair, so obviously I'm going to have curly hair. But like brain surgery, that took away my curls. And like, I know it doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but like for me it is, to like look back and go, like, that was my hair. But like, I've had my head shaved so many times that like, it's just like ruined the natural style of my hair.
It's like, it's just yet another thing that the condition has taken from you that you had no control over.
Yeah.
But moving on to some slightly more I'd say, positively thinking things. I obviously met you over TikTok, so I was hoping you could just shed some light about your TikTok page, what made you start it. I love watching your daily vlogs. I do watch them every day. And yeah, I just hoping you could talk a bit about that.
So I started my TikTok in January of this year after having an extremely challenging 2023. And I wanted a place to document my good days as well as my bad days. So on the days that I was feeling down, I could watch my vlogs back and see that despite having bad days, I've also had good days. And I decided to make this public so that everyone, no matter whether they have an illness or they don't have an illness, that they can see that not everyone has a perfect life that I find social media typically shows. And like, although I am doing this for me, I also want to do it to help other people.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think I love the way you start off those vlogs.
Thank you.
Anybody listening, Amelia says, day whatever it is of making 2024 a better year than 2023. And it's just like, people have bad things happen in a year and it can just really put their year down. And then the way you phrase it, it's like, in spite of everything that's happened, I am going to make the most of this. And it's just such a refreshing thing to hear.
I'm just like trying to see like the silver light of like every day, like even if like it's just like something as small as like watching like my favorite series, or like something bigger such as getting to see my friends. Like, it doesn't matter how big or small.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, something that you do sometimes in your vlogs is, and I don't know if there was a specific reason for this that I missed towards the beginning of your vlogs when I hadn't found your page, but you have a memory stick and you upload photos to that. Is there a specific reason for that, or is that just something you do?
No, not really. I literally only started this year because my phone storage is completely running out, and I literally, photos and videos, they're literally memories that I literally dread the thought of them going. So
yeah,
I'm just trying to get them all into a memory stick so I can save them the storage on my phone.
That's fair enough.
Because I'm definitely one to take loads of photos and videos.
Yeah, no, me too. I'm always the one with my phone out.
Literally.
So yeah, I guess the final question I wanted to ask you is how we can raise awareness about lesser known conditions such as IAH, specifically in society, so that the general population, you know, are more understanding, know better, and can aid people with IAH.
So I feel like we need to encourage people to talk about their illnesses and how it affects them. It works two ways. People like me need to talk about it more, and people without chronic illness need to educate themselves about it more. If people with rare chronic illnesses don't talk about their illness enough, then they can't expect other people to know about their illness. The reason I agreed to take part in this interview is because I feel like not everyone pays attention to posters, and I feel like it may like do a better job to spread awareness via talking, and I feel like your podcast is a really good method to do this.
No, definitely. I that was the whole reason we started this, is raising awareness, that sort of thing, because there's such a gap in the knowledge about chronic illnesses.
There is, definitely, because like I can't be annoyed at people for not knowing if I don't talk about it myself. But also, like, with posters, the amount of posters that I've just walked past and not paid attention to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Like, there needs to be ways that people will be receptive to. And it's hard to know what society will respond to until you try something and it does or doesn't work.
Exactly. Like, still put the posters out there, but don't rely on just posters.
Like, definitely.
I guarantee, like, if there was a poster about IAH and like another one about, like, I can't think off the top of my head, but like a more common illness, people would donate money to the more common illness because they don't know anything about IAH.
Also, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, but if you have a condition with a really long, complicated name that has a load of medical jargon in it, if you're putting that in a poster, people are going to get so overwhelmed trying to read it. That's why something like stroke or cancer, because they're common now and everybody knows it and the jargon isn't so medical, people are more aware and will read more about it. Whereas if you put idiopathic intracranial hypertension on a poster, that is not something that people are going to think, oh, I want to read that because it's too much overwhelming wording.
Literally, like when I tell people about my diagnosis, they're like, hang on a minute, can you say that again? Can you repeat it? Because it's actually a lot to take in. Like, obviously, I've heard it all my life and like I've had to repeat it all my life. But
yeah,
for someone that's never heard of it, it is literal jargon.
Yeah, well, every time I try to say it, I always have to prepare myself because it's just that little bit harder to say.
It doesn't just roll off your tongue, no.
Yeah. And also, like, I feel like in addition to that, considering like things like cancer and stroke, they're more common, people know, like, have a basic idea of like how what a cancer patient might or what a stroke patient might go through.
Yeah.
And but like at the same time, if you talk about things like IIH or FND, they might not really know and they might be really confused, like, and they might not also like want to look further into it. They're like, okay, this is too complicated, I don't understand this.
Yeah, and it's so, like you have to be, I feel like the only people who really do their research on these things are people who know somebody with it and know them well, or if they have it themselves. Otherwise, it's a bit right now as, oh, well, it's not my...
Yeah, it's completely.
It's nothing to do with me. But yeah, I think that's definitely podcasts, like people who have high influences, like TikTok, I think is a great way nowadays to...
Oh, definitely.
Go and spread things.
I feel like it's the number one way now.
Yeah, because I remember the reason I was aware you had IIH was because of that post I did on International Rare Disease Day.
Yeah.
And then you commented. Yeah, and like the amount on that comment, on like the comments that I'd never heard of before. But then also one thing I did find with that is a load of people were like putting their diagnosis down, and then someone in the comments would be like, that's not rare. And I was like, just because it's not rare, it doesn't mean we have to tell someone that they can't write something down. Like, people are going to find a community. Yeah.
Thing is, though, by people commenting, it like gives them a chance to like for other people to like see it as a safe space to go, okay, I'm not alone, like someone else has the same thing as me.
Yeah, the amount of people I found who had EDS, which was so helpful for me when I found I had EDS, I was like, I literally scrolled through and found people who said EDS and like went onto their pages to try and see if there was anything that I could like take advice wise. I don't know if anybody from that TikTok specifically saw that you had IIH and was like, oh my gosh. And then I don't know if there was that, but the fact that somebody could just come across that and go, oh my gosh, it's somebody with the same thing as me.
Thing is though, like the TikTok algorithm, even though you posted that must be ages ago now, that TikTok could still pop up on someone's For You page.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's so weird, the TikTok algorithm. Just
it literally is. Like, apparently people post something like 1 month and then like it goes viral like 5 months later. Like, that is really crazy.
Yeah. Well, that was, because that one got, I think, 27,000 views, which was like,
whoa.
Yeah, it was like so many. And I was like, and I haven't got anything close to it since, but I was like, oh my gosh, the fact that so many people saw and commented and interacted with it to be like, this is what I've got, let me share that with a bunch of strangers.
Mm-hmm. It's, do you know what, I feel like when used correctly, it is actually such a safe place.
Yeah, when if you find the right community, it's
you gotta find the right one.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Braincast Hidden Disabilities. It's been a pleasure talking to you and raising awareness about idiopathic intracranial hypertension. Anything we've spoken about that might have links to websites, we will try and upload in the description for anybody watching.